You're tuned to The Weekend, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines, your host for The Weekend, and joining us today on the first part of this two-part weekend is Peter Schwarzbein, and Peter is going to talk about an interesting trip that he took not too long ago, and this is a trip that he took to China. And he didn't go there as a city representative, but part of the Sister Cities International, and he's going to tell us a little bit about that. Peter, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Louis.
Now, tell us a little bit about Sister Cities International.
So Sister Cities International is one of the oldest citizen diplomacy nonprofits in the world. It was founded September 11th, 1956 by Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower, obviously after being involved in World War II and then later as a president, recognized the need for a sort of soft power, soft diplomacy. And he felt that, quite honestly, the best way to avoid World War III was to have city-to-city contact, people exchanging both cultural and economic issues and attitudes. And so Sister Cities International was set up on September 11th, 1956, dedicated to promote a cultural and economic exchange between cities on the subnational level. A lot of those original Sister Cities relationships, it's an American sister city with a sister city from another country. The majority of them that started after 1956 were in Germany and were in Japan. And you still see a lot of that. As the program expanded throughout the decades, you saw Sister Cities relationships established in Russia during the Cold War. You see them in Israel. You see them across the world in Latin America. And Sister Cities relationships, although is reinvigorated the last couple of years in El Paso, we've had Sister Cities relationships with Jerez, Spain, with Chihuahua, with Ciudad Juarez, as well as Qatara.
Now, it's interesting, as we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that a lot of times, and Peter, we've heard this ourselves being from El Paso or living in the Southwest, that a lot of people will say sometimes, well, we're out in the middle of nowhere, and that's not the case.
And that was kind of the observation that I had there. You know, I was not there as an official representative of the city of El Paso, although I'm a representative of the city of El Paso day and night, whether or not I'm city councilman. But I was there as a board member of Sister Cities International, invited on behalf of the People's Republic of China. And what was interesting was observing and hearing these different speakers. The mayor of Scottsdale was there. There were representatives from the state legislature in New York that were talking about, you know, the conference was a Healthy Cities Conference. And so you had people focusing on what urban planning could affect public health, different programs that other cities had enacted to improve and encourage better public health, both in China and in the United States. And through those meetings, it really made me think about, well, what are we doing here as a community? And made me realize that a lot of the programs that we're focusing on here in terms of our quality of life bond projects, in terms of our investment through multiple institutions with the medical industry here on both sides of the border are really programs that are improving our public health and are keeping us not 5 years behind but on the leading edge of what a lot of cities are doing. And one of those that we were focusing as well that I observed is the streetcar project. Most people aren't necessarily thinking about these vintage streetcars as a public health component, but what it does do is it allows us to have a more holistic approach towards offering different opportunities for development of multimodal transportation options, of people being able to enjoy a day not necessarily being in a car, whether that is to go to a restaurant, to downtown, or to go to downtown up to a restaurant. Or as you're already seeing along Stanton Street in Kansas, there's new apartments, there's new development there. So even ideally, somebody could go and live along the streetcar route and take it to go to work downtown or take it to go to work at UTEP. And I think that's kind of the opportunity there that you see that allows us to grow our city in a more holistic way, to focus not just on necessarily the outskirts of our city, but also the inner core as well.
And you mentioned vintage, and this is something that a lot of people will look at something and go, oh, that's really cool, it's vintage, and you know, what's old is new again, and people like nostalgia. They like to go back and look at the old days. A lot of people who have lived here in El Paso for quite a while remember the streetcars. So they may look at this streetcar project and go, ah, this is just the way it used to be. And then some of the people who weren't around during those streetcars will say, this is a pretty cool idea.
Yeah. You know, when I first started working on the streetcar project, I was an artist and an activist trying to save the streetcars. The city at one point in 2012 was trying to sell them. We tried getting them placed onto the Quality of Life bond. I collected with some friends over 1,800 signatures, which was more than any other citizen-generated bond project. And that really helped the city lobby the state for it eventually became the $97 million of funding. What I think is really remarkable is that there was a discussion back 2012, 2013, do we go and use the original streetcars, the presidential conference cars, or do we go and use a replica vintage streetcar? And nobody, you know, it's the difference between Coke Zero and Coca-Cola from a glass bottle, right?
Yes.
It tastes better. Sure, you know, when you have the real sugar, it tastes better. And that is our original streetcars. The cars that we have, you know, they were designed in 1935. President Roosevelt, FDR, said he wanted a streetcar that can run in any temperate climate in the United States. And out of the four streetcar manufacturers, this was the winning design. And the streetcars that we're going to have up and running again here are Art Deco design. You know, they look like they're moving even when they're still. It was really the sort of the height of sort of American design as it related towards transportation and Art Deco. And so these cars are really, really beautiful. And what's really remarkable, and I recently went on a trip to sort of look at the interior design and to sort of support staff in talking with Brookville Equipment Corporation, who are the oldest streetcar manufacturers in the United States in Brookville, Pennsylvania, was we're really going to have the best of both worlds. We're going to have those old, and I say those classic shells, that classic look that was the original streetcar that ran over 500 trips a day between El Paso and Juarez, with the best of modern components. There is going to be HVAC. They will be ADA compliant and accessible. There will be bike racks. There will be Wi-Fi on the streetcars. And they'll also have modern diagnostics and propulsion. So it's not you'll be able to go and look through the system through computers and not just necessarily just mechanical as well. So really it's the best of both worlds. And what's really remarkable, especially kind of in this political climate that we're in and the conversations we're having and sometimes in an unfortunate way on a national level, is our city has chosen to bring back a symbol that shows some of the best values that we share here on the border. And that is, in a lot of ways, border crossing and the way things cross define us as a community, whether it's music or family or economics or language, you know, we all have different reasons for wanting to cross, and that really is what makes El Paso and Ciudad Juarez so beautiful and interesting and amazing. And we're taking a symbol of that shared – of those shared values and that joy and bringing it back. And there's a political statement with that as well. And in less than 2 years, we'll be writing that history once again. And anybody that's coming to visit our city will know about that. Because it seems at this time, you know, when we have this discourse about walls or other things, our city is choosing to build trolleys. We're choosing to build connections, not just to our past, but to our future as well. And I think that's great.
And Peter, as we all know that in order to make progress, sometimes you have some inconveniences. And some people may complain about sometimes, you know, oh, the freeway is closed or this street is closed. Tell us a little bit about perhaps what can people expect, you know, while this streetcar project gets underway?
Well, it's a very good question. I think probably by the time of this taping, of this airing, there will probably be some significant street closures or getting ready to be street closures from Stanton Street from Schuster to Baltimore. That's going to be one of the larger chunks there. It's really going to affect Mission Hills, Kern Place, Romeria, and the UTEP students as well. And It will be there for about 3 months. I wish I could tell you that it will be painless and easy, but you'll have cars that were not going down certain streets and now they're going down certain streets. And for Stanton itself, it will be open with one northbound lane and no southbound lane traffic on Stanton Street. I'm not necessarily happy about it, but it's part of that progress. You know, what my office is focused on is making sure that those closures and those alternatives for traffic are communicated in as robust manner as possible. We started a text message traffic alert system about 8 months ago as well, that we have close to 2,000 people signed up for. And so that's something that helps as well. But, you know, this is a tremendous investment and opportunity for our city, not just, again, for economic development, but also cultural pride as well. And it's the difficulties with that will not be forever, but we're going to have to sit with them for a few months.
And I guess people can kind of look back and perhaps see what happened with the Brio project. When that first was being worked on, you know, people were saying, well, when is this going to be done? And now it's like, you know, Brio is such a convenience for a lot of people who use it.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's what do they say? If you want to make an omelet, you got to crack some eggs. So I think that this is part of it. I think that we're not talking about the sort of Border West Expressway and the GO-10 projects, the I-10 projects that are really I hear about daily. But we're planning for a more successful future in terms of how we transport ourselves and our community. Austin doesn't have that option. Austin is built out. Austin can't create the capacity to help with their traffic. And there's no way out for them. They can't build more highways. They're developed in a lot of ways. And El Paso has the opportunity with the Border West Express and with GO-10 to build out for that future with more anticipated growth in our community.
And this is the time of year, you know, the beginning of the year, a new year, the fact that, you know, people coming in from for the holidays, for the Sun Bowl. And looking to the future, I would imagine that, you know, these streetcars are going to be nothing but, you know, a great attraction for people who come visit to this city.
I mean, it's, you know, these are museum pieces brought back to life. Every single, you know, every single Sun Bowl trailer that they show is going to show the streetcar coming down Oregon Street or, you know, a ride behind the trolley conductor going downtown. The best part about it, it's not like it's a made-up thing. It's part of our history and identity. I mean, each one could have a plaque like you see in a memorial or a historical plaque that says from 1902 to 1974 existed one of the only international streetcar lines in the entire world, an all-electric streetcar line. At the height of this line, over 500 trips a day ran between El Paso and Juarez on these streetcars. Even though the car doesn't ride to Juarez now, we still remember those days fondly. That could be written on every one of these cars on a plaque. But it's not sitting in a museum. It's riding in our streets again. And it's letting visitors and ourselves know about our values here. And if you want to know where you're going, you got to know where you come from. And the streetcar is a big part of that story.
Peter, for people who might have, you know, perhaps additional questions about the streetcars, can they go to your website or where can they find out?
So they can email our office at district1@elpasotexas.gov. And they can also contact, I think it's facebook.com, EP Streetcar is also the Facebook page as well that is helping with this as well.
Well, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here today, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you as well.
We've been visiting with Peter Schwartzbein, and he is talking about his trip that he took to China as part of the Sister Cities International, and that this was the third annual Healthy Cities Conference sponsored by Sister Cities International and the People's Republic of China, and also talking about the streetcars, which is something that, as Peter mentioned during the interview, a museum piece that's actually out there, not just sitting in a museum. Thanks for being with us. And when we come back on the weekend, it's snowing in Hawaii. And joining us on the second part of the weekend today is Mike Guardia. Mike is an internationally recognized author and military historian. If you remember, we interviewed him on the book club when he wrote Hal Moore, and that was A Soldier Once and Always, and that was the very acclaimed Army biography about Hal Moore. And he's also written Bradley versus BMP, The Fires of Babylon. And as I mentioned, he's a veteran of 6 years in the military, where he served active duty as an armor officer. And Mike, tell us a little bit about Hal Moore and what made you decide to, because that's, I guess, as you mentioned when we first interviewed you, the movie that Mel Gibson did was perhaps one of the closest to the Vietnam War that we've seen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, it was the movie that really inspired me to find out a lot more about Hal Moore. Because after the movie, I went back and I read the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and I also read the follow-up book to that that he wrote called We Are Soldiers Still. And after reading those two books, I went out to try and see if there was a biography of Moore himself, because his service in Vietnam was really just a snapshot of his entire life and career. And I was surprised to see that there was no biography out there yet, despite how popular Moore himself was. And at that point, that was what inspired me to really take up the task and try and interview Moore himself and really get his biography out there so that all the readers could see not only what he did in Vietnam, but also what he did when he was in the Korean War, also when he served in occupied Japan, and how he really helped rebuild the military in the wake of the post-Vietnam malaise.
As I mentioned earlier, you are, I guess, a military historian. You've written three other books in addition to the Hal Moore book. This is a big turn here from military historian to all of a sudden it's snowing in Hawaii.
Yes, yes it is.
So what inspired you to write It's Snowing in Hawaii?
Well, I was really inspired to write this children's book because I'm the proud dad of two little girls, and I absolutely love being a father. Having my two little girls around, as of right now, they're ages 3 and 4, and they are a continuous source of inspiration for me. I mean, they're such a delight to have around, and I can trace the idea to the book to this past winter, as a matter of fact, when we were playing. And we were watching a Hawaiian-themed cartoon on TV, and where we were at the time, it was snowing outside. You know, we live in the continental U.S. And I was looking outside at the snowfall, and as we were watching the Hawaiian TV show, I thought to myself, well, hey, gosh, what would happen if it actually snowed in Honolulu? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought to myself, hey, you know what? I think that would be a pretty solid idea for a children's book. And with that in mind, I started putting the pen to the pad shortly after I put my girls to bed that night. And what really spurred me on was that I wanted to make a story for my daughters. I wanted them to be able to hold a book in their hands and say that this is something that my daddy wrote for me. And ever since the book has come out, it has become a regular part of our bedtime story routine.
So I was going to say your little girls had the privilege of having the first copy read to them by their daddy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you have I read a little bit of the book because it's, you know, it's available on Amazon and a lot of the other bookstores, and you wrote it in a rhyming style, yet you seem to be able to put just about everything from Hawaii in this little book, and it's a great opportunity to learn about Hawaii, but also throwing in that snow.
Mm-hmm.
So would you mind reading a little bit about it, about the
Absolutely.
Book or all of it?
Absolutely. Well, I have a copy of the book right here in front of me, so I will go ahead and read the first few pages of it. And as the book starts off, I'll go ahead and put my narrator voice on. It starts off, oh me, oh my, it's snowing in Hawaii. So the weatherman says, whatever shall we do? It's never snowed before in the town of Honolulu. The kids enjoy their snow day, the first they've ever had. They build Hawaiian snowmen. This snow business ain't so bad. Icicles hang from palm trees. The lays are hard as rocks. and the coconuts and pineapples have turned to frozen blocks. Over at the Navy base, the sailors don their skates. Pearl Harbor's frozen solid, so they make figure eights. Where have all the sailboats gone? Have the fishermen gone away? Of course not, silly goose. They're ice fishing in Kahana Bay. No surfing at the snow-covered beach. The weather won't allow it. But the surfers race their snowmobiles to see how fast they'll plow it. No touchdowns in Aloha Stadium, but oh, what a sight. Students all get ready for their college snowball fight. Never a dull moment at the Dole Plantation, for the planter's men have all become newest bobsledding sensation. And I'll leave off there.
What some people have who I've interviewed before on the book club on Perspectives have talked about how hard it is to write a children's book. And you've gone from not just an historian, but a military historian to a children's book. How difficult was it to make that transition, Mike?
Well, for me, I really didn't find the transition all that hard at all. I think probably the hardest part of the process wasn't really writing the story. It was really just trying to find a publisher and find an artist and try to package myself and also market myself as someone who could transition into writing children's stories, because most of the publishers out there, you know, when they see the name Mike Guardia, they automatically associate it with, oh, okay, well, that's the guy in the military. He writes military books. How can he really manipulate his voice into telling a children's story? So it was a bit of a task for me to say, well, hey, you know, this is just me trying to show that I can be versatile. This is me doing something that's inspired by me being a father of two young girls. You know, it's really something that was inspired by the heart. And I think once that started to take hold, it was a bit easier for me to make inroads that way.
Now, you mentioned finding an artist, and the artwork in this book is just incredible. I mean, especially when you read about the Navy base, the sailors don their skates, Pearl Harbor's frozen solid, so they make their figure eights, and the artwork there is just incredible.
Oh, it is. It is head and shoulders above anything I imagined. The artist, her name is Melanie Stevens, and she's been a children's book artist for a while. You know, she also does a lot of graphic design. And it is just incredible what she did with all of these illustrations. I mean, she was able to take the very rough storyboard that I gave her. I mean, and this was just a storyboard that I did with little squiggly lines and some stock photographs. I mean, I have zero artistic talent at all. If there was a way to mess up doing stick figures, I could probably do it. But she was able to take these rough concepts that I had given her with stick figures and just turned it into an incredible piece of artwork. So I really think the children who read this book, they will enjoy the pictures, and I think the pictures is going to be what stays with them more than anything.
Now, as far as the book itself, it shows a lot of imagination, which, you know, it's okay when you're it's written as a children's book, but at the same time, you were very careful in making sure that the Hawaii and the historic Hawaii was true to nature. Was that difficult to put into a children's book? I mean, when it's never snowed in Hawaii, not as far as I'm aware of, did you come up with this in your mind? Because, you know, as daddies, we make up a lot of stories for our kids. I know my children would say, Daddy, we want you to read a story, and then a Bible story, and then one from your mind, which meant you make up a story as it goes.
Right. Well, I got to tell you, if I was not a daddy, I probably never would have thought of this story in a million years. It was something that I made up as I went along. I mean, I pretty much just took out my legal pad, and then I started scribbling down some notes, and about halfway through bleeding my thoughts down on paper, I thought to myself, hey, you know, I could probably make this into a rhyming scheme if I really tried. So I think the imaginative process for me was really inspired by just all of the fun that I have with my daughters. And I think it was just me. I really think it was me just being motivated to write them a story that inspired me to just take all of these bits and pieces of Hawaiian culture and, you know, just try and put them into a winterized theme and thinking to myself, okay, well, what are some winter sports that I know of? Well, there's figure skating, there's bobsledding, and hey, wouldn't it be silly if, like, Pearl Harbor just froze solid and all the sailors, you know, started doing ice capades on there? And, yeah, so it, I think the imaginative process was made a lot easier for me because it was inspired by the love that I have for my little girls.
And it's a good thing that they don't have snowball fights there because they're coconuts, correct? Now, tell us, you mentioned that it was difficult to approach publishers and artists. You mentioned Melanie, your artist, and as I mentioned, she's done a great, fantastic job on this book. What about the publishers, and finally, how did you convince Melanie to make this a go?
Well, how I sold it to them was that, I had some pretty established success as a military author, and the reason why I wanted to make this, the reason why I wanted to take this leap into children's literature wasn't really based on any preconceived notions on how the book would do financially. That the big motivation that I had in wanting to put the story out there in the marketplace wasn't really motivated by me making it wasn't motivated by me making a spot on any bestseller list. But the big motivation I had was that I wanted to have the story out there for posterity. You know, I wasn't expecting to be the next Margaret Brown. I wasn't expecting to be the next Shel Silverstein. I really just wanted to have a fun story that was out there and really wanted it to be something that I could share with my girls over the years to come. And if and when they have children of their own, they can say, you know, hey, this is something that Grandpa made for me. And now I'm going to hand it down to you. And I think once I communicated that motivation, it was easier for the publisher to take me on because it was something that they knew actually came from the heart.
And what about, we talk a lot about, you know, artists and graphic artists, and as I mentioned, the pictures in this book are just awesome. But what about the cover? Because a lot of times that's what sells, too, is people look at the cover and they'll go, that's pretty interesting.
Right. Well, when we were in the final stages of the book production, the publisher gave me the option to either have a customized cover or to tweak one of the interior illustrations to become the cover. So I looked through all the spreads that she gave me, and the one that really stood out to me was the one with the Hawaiian snowman and the children, you know, putting it together with the hula skirt and the little pineapple eyes. And I said to myself, you know, if I think there's any image in the book that would really grab a reader's attention, that would, you know, just highlight the imaginative theme of the book of, you know, hey, it never snows in Honolulu, but if it did, this is what it would look like. You know, you have a snowman who's dressed up like a hula dancer. Hey, you know, that's silly and that's fun. And then that would probably be the one image that would really grab the reader's, you know, attention.
Well, Mike, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to share with us this gift that you presented to your daughters and sharing it with us. We've been visiting with Mike Guardia. The new children's book is It's Snowing in Hawaii, and again, by Mike Guardia, and it's available online at any other bookstore that you may want to go. Again, it's Snowing in Hawaii by Mike Guardia. Mike, thank you very much for being with us.
Absolutely, Louie. Thank you so much for having me on the show again.
And you have a great new year.
All right, sir. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Lauren Terrazas. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Sainz.